Welcome to the Nonprofit Growth Show, presented by Nonprofit Megaphone, the podcast where we highlight nonprofit leaders in the trenches who share the strategies and tactics they use to grow their organizations and make a difference each day. As we like to say, if you want to be discouraged by a general sense of decay, read the news. But if you want to be inspired by concrete stories of growth, talk to a nonprofit. Here's to the modern day superheroes, the nonprofit leaders. Let's dive in.
Hello, we're here with Ava Rosenroth. She's the Director of Institutional Giving at the New York Foundling. Ava, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me on the show. I really like your intro. I feel like that's a lot to live up to, saying that now I feel like I need to inspire people, but that's what I strive for.
You're going to. Yeah, no, I'm really excited for our conversation. You've had lots of cool experiences. And as has become our custom, I would love if you could jump right in with a story of maybe something dramatic or exciting that has happened in your nonprofit development career.
Sure. Yeah. So when I first started out in development, like many people, I started as a development assistant. I was working for a small nonprofit organization. I was the only person on the development team, the only person doing development. And it was the first time ever that I was in charge of organizing a mass mailing. I had never done this before. I didn't understand. One of the many things that I didn't understand was the importance of keeping the donor letters with the names on them in the same order that the address envelopes were in.
Oh.
Yeah. So everything got completely out of order. I had to stay very, very late. I spent a lot of time sorting through, trying to match each letter, like the first name on each letter with the name on the envelope, which was not always easy because sometimes like the letter was addressed to, you know, like the name is written a little bit differently. And I was working very late trying to sort and match everything. So that taught me a very valuable lesson. I'm not going to make that mistake again. So that was one story. I do want to share another thing on a little more of a serious note, because that was kind of like not as serious, a more disturbing moment earlier in my career was I had a meeting with a donor who had kind of a bad reputation for being inappropriate with people. And you know how the Me Too movement, that kind of thing. And my boss at the time told me, I had this meeting coming up, said, you know, this guy has a reputation, so you should wear something sexy to the meeting. Like my boss
what?
Thought that would get the person to give more money to our organization, which I don't think is really how that works. One of the things that I learned from that is like now that I'm in the position of managing newer employees, I really want to make sure not only that they're given the chance to learn from everything, from making mistakes or getting envelopes out of order or whatever, but also that they feel safe and that they know their worth, because I think that's a huge issue in this sector and in any sector, really.
Absolutely.
But I think that the power imbalance when you have donors and development staff, that's an issue that happens, unfortunately, too frequently, like any situation where there's a power imbalance.
What ended up happening in that donor meeting? Do you mind me asking? Did it go okay?
Nothing happened. I mean, I didn't. It went fine. It went fine. It went fine. I didn't think that I was like, now I'm thinking back, I don't even remember what I wore to that meeting. But I certainly didn't actually try to wear anything sexy to impress. I didn't go into it like, oh, I'm really believing what she said and being like, I have to try and seduce this person into giving us a donation. I didn't go into it with that mindset. I kind of like brushed off the comments. And then looking back on it now, I'm like, now that I'm a manager in a development department, I'm like, well, that's an example of a way that I never want anybody to feel.
Right. Wild. That is wild. Thank you for sharing that. Then maybe sort of bringing us into the present day, I would love to hear the story of how you got to where you are today in your role as Director of Institutional Giving at the New York Foundling.
Yeah. So I worked when I first graduated. I guess I should start with this is going back a little far, but like how I got into nonprofit work in general. I actually was a theater major as my undergraduate. And at some point, I realized that I didn't actually want to be an actress. And I started kind of dipping my toe into other things. And I applied to the MPA program at Binghamton University. I took a class in grant writing. And, you know, it's funny because when I first did that, I kind of did it with the idea that, oh, this is going to be a skill that's going to help get me through a really tough economy, right? It was like, oh, this is like a marketable skill. I kind of was just looking for something. The economy was bad. And I was looking for something that would get me hired, but I ended up really liking it. And then when I was looking for jobs, that's what made me want to start looking for development jobs. I worked for a couple of smaller nonprofits before I started working at the Fowling. And I mean, the way I got that job was I applied for it on the internet. So it's not really that interesting. Since I got hired as a grant writer, I've been here for 6 years now. I started as a grant writer. I was initially doing just foundation and corporate grant applications. And gradually over my time here, I started doing government grant applications. And now I oversee both sides of it, the foundation side, the corporate side, and the government grant side.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Fascinating. That is such a cool journey. And I think maybe similar to other journeys where it wasn't necessarily what you planned from the outset, but it did work out well.
Yeah. I got a reputation for being really good at submitting lots of paperwork. And so people kept giving it to me.
It's beautiful. It's great. Is there a story you could tell about your organization that sort of crystallizes for you the difference that you're making or trying to make in the world?
Yeah. So this is a difficult question because the Foundling is so large and we have so many different programs that do great work. It's difficult to narrow it down to just one story. So we're a multi-service human services organization. We work with families who are involved in the child welfare system, the juvenile and criminal justice system. We work with people with developmental disabilities, and we provide services that touch on every aspect of their life, their health, their medical, mental, and behavioral health. Social services, we provide education services. Some of our most groundbreaking work has been in advancing the citywide application of evidence-based practices in the child welfare and juvenile justice system. We're also doing groundbreaking work in education that's tailored to the needs of children in the child welfare system who are at very heightened risk of falling behind in school. However, I know all those stats, which I find very interesting, make for very boring radio. So I want to share a story about the Foundling's crisis nursery, a story about, you know, an individual person. Our crisis nursery is a respite program. It supports parents who have a crisis in their life that's preventing them from caring for their children if they don't have a support network. And you'll see from the story what an example of that could look like. But it could be any kind of crisis in their life. If they don't have a support network or somebody who could care for their child while they're getting help, whether it be with a health situation or with addiction or housing or anything in their life. So there was an apartment fire a few years ago, and a pregnant woman was burned, and she had burns on 80% of her body. She gave birth prematurely because she was in this very traumatic fire. And the baby was premature, but was released from the ICU while the mother was still recovering from her burns. And in fact, she had to be placed in a medically induced coma while she was recovering. It was very challenging. The mother was an immigrant from West Africa. She had no support network in the United States. Prior to the fire, she was in the process of breaking off an abusive relationship. And we had to work with the administration for children's services. And the mother agreed to place the baby in the crisis nursery while she was recovering. Our crisis nursery has, you know, round the clock 24/7 care for children up to age 10 or 12 if they're there with a younger sibling. So the crisis nursery team would bring the baby to the hospital so that the mother could bond with her child. We brought the baby to all of her medical appointments, and our child care worker gave her guidance on how to care for the baby since this was also her first child. And this mother, her hands were covered with burns. It was painful for her to even hold her child, but she was so determined to do that and to be able to care. Like she was happy to be able to bond with her child. Before she was discharged from the hospital, our team worked with her to help secure visiting nurse services, homemaking services, preventive services, and she was eventually able to take the baby home. We provided her with supports like a stroller, clothing, bottles, formula, everything that she would need to be independent and to get her family off to the right start. And I'm proud to share that today they're living independently, and the mother and the baby, and that she's on track for all of her developmental milestones. So that's one story of a way that our program really changed somebody's life.
That is incredible.
I also can, while we're on the subject of the crisis nursery, I feel like I should give a shout out because we do have a helpline for parents who are in crisis. Can I give the helpline number?
Absolutely. Please do.
Sure. The helpline number is 888-435-7553.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, that is an incredible resource and such a remarkable story. That is wild. Thank you for sharing. I don't even know how do we continue the conversation after that. I guess the best way to continue with it is maybe zooming in on your role on the resourcing side of the organization. Are there tactics or strategies or approaches that you have found to be helpful in your work that maybe other folks at other nonprofits might be able to apply as well or experiment with in their sort of fundraising and giving work?
Yeah. This question is a little bit of a hard one for me because I almost never try anything if I would be surprised if it was successful. I'm generally a very calculating person. I like calculate all of my my success rates for my grant applications and everything. So, there is one thing that surprised me, and that's I've been surprised by my ability to challenge donors' perceptions about clients. Because we work with families who are struggling, we work with young students, people with developmental disabilities, and a lot of times, these may not be groups of people who our donors are used to seeing face to face. And so, there was a time in my career when I'd be nervous about having donors meet with clients. I would think, what if a kid says the wrong thing? What if they rub the donor the wrong way in this meeting? But I found that almost always it's been a very rewarding experience. It's been unpredictable, which goes back to like me being very calculating and being like uncomfortable with taking risks that I can't exactly like calculate ahead of time. But generally, I've found it to be very rewarding.
Fascinating. Right. And it probably is real in a way that something that's fully calculated out can't be, and probably worth the risk, as you shared. That's really cool.
Yeah. You know, I had a meeting with a funder recently with a client who was a young student. And surprisingly, like the student was unable to get childcare and she had a baby. And so she brought the baby into the meeting with the funder. The baby was crying. I was like, oh no, is the funder going to be, frustrated by the situation? They were super understanding. And it actually illustrated more like the value of the work.
Absolutely. That's a great story. How do most, for you and for your organization, how do most new relationships with potential funders come about? Is it people hearing through other people or learning about it through PR or your online presence? How does that typically shake out?
Yeah, so it really varies for institutional funders. And I think, coming from my background in institutional giving, it's kind of unique because you can be very targeted. You can look up information like funders, unlike individuals, will post information publicly on like, how to submit an application, tell you exactly how they want to be contacted. So the most important thing to my mind is looking at their website, looking at the information that's available, and using that to guide how to reach out to them. That said, another thing is using our network. So I'll talk to other people, and I'm lucky enough that because we have a very large organization, there's a lot of opportunity for me to kind of use our network and say, oh, does anybody know somebody at this foundation? I noticed that they gave to similar organizations, or I noticed that they have, you know, shared values. They have things in common with us, you know, and really strategize. I work closely with our individual giving team a lot, who also help us nurture those. And they're probably a more useful person to talk to than I am about the individual fundraising side. But from the institutional side, I think the most important thing is just to take advantage of all the information that's available.
Absolutely. I'm just curious, is there an approach that you have if you're applying for a grant or a program through a foundation? Have you ever had a circumstance where you had applied for many years and sort of never gotten it, and then eventually just decided, okay, let's go on to greener pastures? Or is your strategy just always, you know, always continuing to put your hat in the ring, or has that never happened? I'd just be curious to hear about your experience in that area.
I think if we've applied for something year after year and we don't get funding, we need to rethink the way that we approach it. So either we will stop applying if we think that it seems like it's just not going to work, or we'll think about how's a way we can do this differently. Is there somebody else that we could reach out to first? Should we be emphasizing a different thing in our message? I don't like sending the same application to funders year after year if you're getting rejected year after year. It's a waste of both of our time.
That's a great perspective. Yeah, thank you. Fascinating. Random question, and sort of maybe jumping into some of our rapid fire questions. How would you describe yourself if you could only use one word? What would you say and why?
I've already said calculated, but I would also say that I'm very passionate as well. I'm passionate about the work. And I think that drives everything that I do.
Definitely. And that's a good combination. There's the calculation and then also the passion. That's probably a pretty hard to beat combo if I had to guess, but I love it.
Thank you. I hope so.
Yeah. Is there an exciting shift, or are there multiple exciting shifts perhaps that you're seeing taking place in the nonprofit world today?
Yeah. So I think some of the most exciting shifts are, first there was the shift away from the overhead myth of, keeping those, what they call overhead, or what I now like to refer to as infrastructure expenses, trying to keep those costs low. I think that's important to, especially when companies were viewing that as, you know, the primary measure of a nonprofit's worth. I think that's really kind of defeats the purpose, right? Like, I think it's important to give to nonprofits for what they are doing rather than what they're not doing. It really, it's distracting from the focus of the work. And also it prevents growth, which is what this podcast is all about, helping nonprofits grow, right? that infrastructure.
Absolutely,
is so
right. Why focus on the inputs when you can focus on the outputs?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Exactly.
Overhead, what they call overhead expenses, I like to call infrastructure, really helps organizations be able to grow. Investing in fundraising is the only way that you're going to get the funds that you need to grow your operation. So I think that's a very exciting shift. And similarly, I think the shift to funders providing more general operating support that really allows nonprofits not only to invest in infrastructure, but also gives them the flexibility that they need to meet the needs of the community and to really gives them the flexibility, right? So if you give a nonprofit general operating support, they can use those funds to grow their infrastructure, but they could also use it to respond to new needs in the community at a moment's notice. If you have unrestricted funding, and then let's say your community gets hit with something like a disaster, or your community gets hit with something like the opioid epidemic or any like emerging health need, or I guess that's kind of an older need now, but you're able to respond faster to new emerging needs.
Absolutely. Those are great points. And I love the call out of the overhead myth / I've heard it called the nonprofit starvation cycle. Lots of fun names for what is ultimately.
Oh yeah. I like that one.
One of the things that is fascinating to us on the show is the power of networks and communities of practice within the nonprofit world to really sort of make a sustained impact over time and build networks of people that are encouraging each other, inspiring each other, and so forth. Are there people that have been particularly helpful to you in your career, or organizations that have been particularly helpful in your career that you kind of want to give a shout out to?
Yeah. So I have, I think one of the organizations that I've worked with that I'm a big fan of is the Human Services Council. They do a lot of work around advocating for the human services sector when it comes to getting funding for indirect, which is kind of the same thing as infrastructure, for government, like negotiations with government contracts. They've done a lot of great advocacy work. So they really impressed me with the work that they're doing on behalf of the sector.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then I'd be curious, is there something that you understand or appreciate now that you didn't fully appreciate maybe 5 or 10 years ago?
Yes, I think that there's a lot that I appreciate now that I didn't appreciate 10 years ago. I think one of the biggest things is, and this is kind of sounds kind of weird, but this was really important for me, I think, to learn, was the difference between, and I'm talking about emotions in the workplace, but the difference between managing your emotions and suppressing your emotions, which seems like it should be obvious, but it's kind of not. And I think about like when I was early on in my career, you know, I would get into work situations that would get me frustrated. And I felt like that was something that I couldn't let those feelings out, you know, I had to suppress them. And then they would like kind of explode at random times, like when you least want them to, right? So I think one of the things that I've learned to do much better is to just be able to manage my own emotions. Like if I'm feeling a certain way, like really step back and say, you know, okay, how do I deal with this feeling rather than trying to suppress it? It's weird how just like a little bit of word choice really changes your mindset.
Absolutely. I love that. It's such a subtle, or it could seem like such a subtle difference, but makes such an enormous difference. I've felt that too. I don't know if you're into the Enneagram. It's like a personality type, but my Enneagram type has a tendency to sort of suppress the emotions as opposed to dealing with them.
I haven't done that, but now I'm really interested in it.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to check that out.
Just like,
Because when I think about like my early career and how, you know, I would like beat myself up for making mistakes like that label thing. And, and then I would have to kind of suppress those feelings and move on. And it was always about like, how do I prevent myself from having an emotional outburst rather than like, how do I step back and learn from this, you know?
Absolutely. That is so fascinating. Thank you, Ava, for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. It's so fascinating. And I love sort of your calculated and also passionate approach that you take to this type of work. Where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you or if they want to learn more about the Foundling?
So if they want to learn more about the Foundling, they can go to nyfoundling.org. That's nyfoundling.org. We are also on, I forgot to pull up our social media handles. Could you give me one moment?
Absolutely. No, that's great.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, our social media handles are the NY Foundling. So it's NY Foundling, but it's got the in front of it. So it's, and that's on Facebook, we're on Twitter and Instagram.
Perfect. Excellent.
And if you want to find me as a, as an individual human, I have a, you can find me on Twitter at Goodness Geek. That's GoodnessGeek. And you can find my blog, which I'm hoping to actually start updating again soon, at goodnessgeek.com.
I love it. Thank you so much, Ava. This has been a blast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Nonprofit Growth Show, presented by Nonprofit Megaphone. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider sharing it with a friend or giving us a rating or review on your favorite podcast network. We appreciate your support. Until next time.